From 2003 to 2013, Michigan sent over 20,000 juvenile offenders to serve time in adult prisons. Advocates for juvenile justice reform say youth housed in adult prisons are at a much greater risk for sexual abuse and suicide than the adult prison population. And while there's now a sight and sound barrier between juvenile offenders and the adult prison population, that wasn't always the case. The state is now facing allegations from 7 former juvenile offenders that they were sexually abused by both other prisoners and prison staff while housed in those facilities. The state has denied those claims. But if the allegations are true, the state could be facing a big payout to the former juvenile offenders. Here to talk about the lawsuit and what it means for the state and the Michigan Department of Corrections is Ted Roloffs. Ted's been reporting on the lawsuit for Bridge Magazine. He joins us by phone now from Grand Rapids. Welcome back to Current State, Ted.
Good to be with you.
First, lay out just some of the basics for us in this case, please. What are the allegations against the state? And tell us a little bit about the young men who were making these allegations.
Well, I think you laid it out accurately. There's one minor correction. The 20,000 prisoners from 2003 to present sent to adult prison, that's a figure that includes prison, adult probation, and jail. So I just wanted to make that minor correction.
Duly noted.
Yes. As far as what's alleged here, the suit filed in near the end of 2013 originally had 7 plaintiffs. It's been expanded to 11. And the allegations ranging from 2010 through 13 say that with varying degrees of similarity that these prisoners, while under 18, while juveniles, were sexually harassed, abused, sexually assaulted, raped. In some cases, this includes allegations of abuse, harassment, and sexual assault by prison guards. And it happened in facilities across the state, Upper Peninsula, Lower Peninsula. I think there are 10 different facilities named in the lawsuit. That's the essence of the lawsuit.
And can you summarize the state's response? What have they said?
Well, not a whole lot. Publicly, they're just saying they can't comment on it. It's an ongoing suit. Some court documents of the case indicate perhaps one point of view that the state's attorneys are taking is that these allegations are not credible, that these are violent criminals. We shouldn't diminish the seriousness of their crimes.
Is there any dispute over
that? Took place.
Is there any dispute over that? I mean, they were all convicted of felonies, correct?
Oh, yes. And if you look back, I looked at the pre-sentence investigations for a lot of these plaintiffs, and they're in for crimes ranging from armed robbery, assault, car theft, criminal sexual assault, that sort of thing. I think the youngest offense I saw in looking through this occurred when one of these individuals was 14 years old. And you can go back and look at some of the details of how these juveniles got into prison and probably get into a debate as to whether or not they were properly sent to prison, whether that's where they belong. But those are the offenses they were convicted of.
Now, it's also relevant here that some of these cases occurred before a federal mandate in 2012 that required a sight and sound barrier between the juvenile and adult population in state facilities. For context, have conditions improved for juvenile offenders significantly since then?
Well, they're separated now. The state completed the separation in, I think it was August of 2013. The federal standards saying you had to do this took effect in August of 2012, and states were to begin taking steps to accomplish that. With the carrot and the stick analogy here, the stick was you lose 5% of your federal funding if you don't carry this out. So by a year later, in August of 2013, the state separated all juveniles in a single facility in some correctional facility. So all the under 18s were housed together in that prison until they turned 18.
How big a change has that been?
Well, it's significant on one level that prior to this, you had these prisoners sent all over the state to different kinds of prisons, different security levels. You could be housed with a 50-year-old murderer when you were 15 years old. Someone who's there's cases when I looked at some of these allegations, you had individuals who were like 5'6", 5'7", 135 pounds in with a cellmate that might have been 230 pounds, 40 years old. I mean, there are any number of variations of those possibilities when you had juveniles sent all over the state. And the contention of the lawsuit is that part of it is that there's ample evidence well before this federal act took effect in 2012 that putting juveniles in adult prisons is a recipe for lots of difficulty, lots of problems. There's studies going back to the late 1980s indicating that juveniles were five times more likely to be sexually assaulted if they're put in with adults in prison, and that's been replicated since then. So it's even common sense would tell you if you put a 15-year-old in prison with someone who's three times his age and weighs 100 pounds more, that there might be some problems there.
But to what extent has that landscape changed and been addressed by the federal mandate and by what happened in Michigan in August of 2013?
Well, they're now separated, at least. So if you're under 18 and you go to prison, you're not going to be put in with an adult any longer. That wasn't the case prior to the state finally accomplishing this separation.
Have there been any allegations since August 2013 that you know of?
I can't necessarily speak to that. I don't know if there's anything ongoing in the lawsuit that might speak to that.
We're talking with Bridge Magazine reporter Ted Roloffs about his recent articles on a lawsuit filed against the state of Michigan by former juvenile offenders who say they were sexually abused while housed in adult facilities. There is this federal legislation, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, that has guidelines for preventing sexual assaults at prisons. Does the federal government have any oversight in these kinds of cases?
I think any oversight would be minimal. I'm not aware of any direct ongoing oversight that the federal government is undertaking. I think the mechanism that you largely have in place here is the threat of loss of funding if there's evidence you're not accomplishing the aims of the Prison Rape Elimination Act. So it would basically be the threat of loss of funding.
Mm-hmm. In your article, you draw a comparison to a case brought against the state of Michigan by female prisoners in the 1990s. How are these two cases similar, and what can we learn from that case?
Well, you have some of the same attorneys involved in that. One of the key attorneys in that case, as well as in the present case, is Deborah LaBelle of Ann Arbor. She was involved in that lawsuit going back to, I think it was 1996. It was finally settled in 2009, and that was a $100 million settlement the state paid. And one obvious difference is this gender difference. You had female prisoners in one case, and here you have male prisoners. But the broad allegations are the same, sexual harassment, assault, that sort of thing. And who knows what the outcome of this case is going to be. There's some level of validity in saying that the state, by digging in its heels and denying any truth to this, risks another significant payout.
Skeptics also point out, though, that the plaintiffs in this case, as you pointed out, are in part being represented by some of the same attorneys who argued that case. And since the women prisoners won that case, that is really a force in driving this one. Is that raising any significant doubts about the plaintiff's case itself?
I'm not sure I'm following the logic there. Because attorneys were successful in one case, then the second case is less valid. I don't think I understand that.
Well, it's just that since some of the same attorneys are representing both, that there's some degree of opportunism here that is being driven by the attorneys themselves.
Oh. Well, I had some pretty considerable discussions with a couple of the attorneys involved in this case. And I remember, I believe Deborah LaBelle indicated that part of the genesis of this present lawsuit was that as they were wrapping up the female prisoner case, they began receiving complaints that are in the present lawsuit that there was all sorts of abuse going on of male juvenile prisoners in Michigan, and that's where this came from. So they began to pursue that. And I don't ultimately, I guess if it goes to a jury, which would seem highly unlikely, people have to decide whether these cases are valid or not. I read a lot of these depositions and looked at a fair amount of the video that goes with these depositions, and I can tell you there's passages where these prisoners are recounting what happened, and you can look at them as they're recounting this and make up your own mind whether they're fabricating this, but there are some of these passages which are extraordinarily difficult to listen to, and you can also hear that reflected in the prisoner's voice as they're recounting this.
When will we likely see this case settled? We're down to 30 seconds, too, by the way. Do you have a feeling for that?
If you can tell me the next five Super Bowl winners, you know, maybe we'd be on the same page. But these losses, I mean, the last one went 13 years. Yeah. So who knows?
Yeah. We've been talking with Bridge Magazine reporter Ted Roloffs about his recent articles on a lawsuit filed against the state of Michigan by former juvenile offenders who say they were sexually attacked and abused while housed in adult facilities. Ted, thank you.
You bet.